So just first of all, a lot of us have not experienced virtual reality. Mm-hmm. You have, mm-hmm. going back many, many years. Describe it.
There are two versions right now. There's one that we call VR, which you put on some goggles, and then inside you see a different world, and more importantly, you feel as if you're in a different place. Something happens in your brain that transports you, and you actually feel like you're somewhere else, and you can kind of look around, walk around, and maybe even interact with some of the things. That's the virtual reality version. There's another version called AR or MR for mixed reality, where you put on a pair of spectacles or glasses that are clear, and you can see the room you're in as it looks normally, or an office, but there's virtual things in that room that are kind of inside or inserted into your real vision. And those virtual things you can manipulate and move around and inspect and explode, so forth. And that they also feel as if they are really present, even though they may be an imaginary thing or cartoon thing, they actually feel as if they're present. So those two things, that kind of feeling that you're somewhere and then feeling the presence, are both versions, but in both of them there's a felt, something you feel rather than know. And often when you come out of VR or this MR, you remember not having seen things or knowing things, but having felt things, having experienced things. And so what I'm suggesting is that VR will be move us from being Internet of information where we know stuff into an internet of experiences where we feel things.
Give us an example of how it made you feel things. You've talked about a system called The Void that you found profoundly affecting.
So there are a number of different companies with prototype versions of the gear. And the one that I felt had the most complete experience with something called The Void, which is has released as a, what they call an arcade experience, meaning that you have to go to this place and put on not only the goggles, but also gloves and a vest. So you're kind of suiting up, and you're released into a big room, a space that you physically run around in and climb through, and you're transported to a very different place that you have full freedom to move around, and you can pick up things that feel real because there are things that you pick up, and you can feel the walls because they really are there, but they look differently, and you have other people involved, so it's a social experience as well. And for up to 30 minutes, you can wander around seemingly at your own choice, exploring this incredible place that is physically different from where you are. And, floors will fall away and you'll drop down two stories.
That sounds terrifying.
It is. It's thrilling, though, because you didn't really move two stories. You just felt like you did. Or you go up an elevator and there's a wind that comes and you can feel the wind and there's spray and you're going through spider webs and it all feels incredibly real. And that experience is the most complete transportation that I've ever experienced in VR.
You've done it for a long time, so you were somewhat prepared for that intense experience. Many people who aren't, it's said that they can only handle it for about 20 minutes. Is it too intense?
Yeah, in the experiments that other people have done with first-person shooters, which is everybody's kind of familiar with that kind of a video game where you kind of see your gun in front of you and you are there as you kind of make your way through these dark rooms and battlefronts. But when you actually have a virtual reality version of that, where you are immersed in that situation, the researchers have found that is a little bit more emotionally taxing and that people have to kind of withdraw or they have to kind of tone down things a little bit because it's just a little too intense, even for teenage boys. And so we're still learning how to deal with that. But the, the point about the VR is that it puts your something that's not in your head, but further back in your brain, your presence. It puts you there. You're really there, and you feel like you're really there. And that experience is much stronger than just the kind of remote observation that you normally have.
Some have suggested it creates empathy. There's a well-known virtual reality piece that puts you on a street corner in Syria and a young girl goes missing and people have said it made them feel profoundly disturbed about it. Have you gotten a feeling from experiencing virtual reality that was different than anything you would have experienced in film and other media?
Yes. And that's the director of that piece, I think Chris Milk, has called VR an empathy machine in the sense that it can manufacture empathy. And it is possible to do that. And I've had some VR experiences of being on Everest and trying to cross a glacier on one of those rickety aluminum ladders. And it is another terrifying experience. But also in the Syrian camp and feeling like you were really not just witnessing the travails of the refugees, but you were sharing them. And so that's something that would be very difficult for me to do ordinarily, but there I was. And I think one of the challenges for the makers of VR that have come back and I've heard is that while it is possible to kind of leverage or amplify empathy, it's also sometimes difficult because if you have a world where you are actually have total freedom to move around, getting you to kind of pay attention to something or getting you directing you to that place where something is going to happen narratively is actually a challenge because you have all this freedom of something may be happening, but you may be looking behind you when it does. And so while there's the ability to create empathy, the mechanics of that are going to be an artistic challenge.
In fact, someone has said the technology has far outstripped the creative people to use the technology in an effective way. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. And in fact, I would even there currently are no VR experts. We don't know how to do this, really. And what's really going to be interesting is that the only way we're going to understand how VR works is through VR itself. We don't have any other instrument to kind of probe our own psychology and perceptions except VR. And so VR is actually going to be the scientific test bed in which we're going to figure out how our brains and VR actually works because we don't know right now.
Well, it's an interesting moment. At the beginning of film, of one of the famous first films, was someone pointing a gun at the audience and shooting it, and people would duck.
Right.
And the idea of a cut, when we watch a film, we go from one scene to the other and we know it's a transition. There was a whole language created in order to use that in with virtual reality that is yet to be created.
Exactly. We don't know what a dissolve looks like. We don't know how to do all these things or how they feel like. The attempts that they had so far have perplexed people rather than – so there may be an educational aspect as well. But all these things remain in front of us, and we don't know the depth in which how far your emotional can be transferred, where it actually resides. You know, you were mentioning the early films, but if we watched a Mickey Mouse character throw a baseball across in our screen, in the screen, we would say that really moved across. We would really feel that we could see that motion, but in fact, there is no motion. It's just a series of still pictures. That sense of emotion, which we really say is really there, is actually assembled in our brain. And so a lot of the feeling of VR is actually not just in the equipment, but it's actually in our brain as well. So there's kind of a cyborgian combination of the brain plus this technology that makes these experiences. And so a lot of this is going to be exploring the brain to figure it out.
Kevin Kelly is telling us about one of the technological trends which is going to change the world from his book called The Inevitable. Virtual reality has been around for quite a while, but 2016 seems to be the coming out party. Why now?
Yeah, so I was convinced that virtual reality was going to happen in a big way in 1989 when I had the fortune to actually try some of the earliest VR by the guy who invented the term virtual reality, VR, Jaron Lanier. And the quality of that experience where you put on the goggles and you put on the glove was remarkably modern. I mean, it was a very convincing, not that far from what we have right now. The only difference was back in 1989. It cost $1 million in day dollars to make that happen. So the reason why we're talking about it now is that the technology has become cheap enough through smartphones, and smartphones was actually the technology, the three technologies in smartphones that had been hijacked by the VR community to make these things happen. And one of them was having really, really cheap gyroscopic and GPS locations so that you could do your head tracking on a little tiny chip. And the second one was the little tiny screens that you can put in front of your eyes.
Meaning when you move your head, the field of vision moves as though you were in the field of vision.
Right, exactly. That used to be like a $200,000 problem to solve technologically, and now you can buy like a $5 chip to do it. And so the screens were also these high-res tiny screens that put in front of your eyes. Used to be very, very expensive to buy, but now on cell phones have become a commodity. And so that technology has enabled VR to become cheap, and that's why in 2016 we suddenly have gear that is only a couple hundred dollars to buy and will be and is good enough to actually improve.
And there are huge investments going into VR now in all different areas. New York Times readers were surprised to see a little box show up with their newspaper one day, which allowed them to put a telephone into it and watch virtual reality short films that they produced, the Oculus Rift from Facebook, and many other areas. What's Western Washington's piece of this? We have Microsoft here. We have the game company Valve. Is part of this future being created right here?
Absolutely. So Microsoft has been a leader in the MR version, where you put on a clear visor or spectacle and you have this virtual insertion into your life and to the view. And they've done tremendous advances. Jaron Lanier, the guy who invented virtual reality, is working with Microsoft. He's actually employed by Microsoft to make this thing happen. And I think the thing that most impresses me about their gear, which they called the HoloLens, is that they're really in the forefront of doing a teleconference version, a telepresence. So having another person sitting next to you whose avatar is virtually there, but it's not just a cartoon. It's actually a reflection of someone else, that person sitting, say, 1,000 miles away.
So I'm sitting in the studio with you, but with this technology, you could be
right
at home, and it would feel as though I'm looking at you and talking to you.
And the key word is feel. And so what it is they have cameras over there, and they capture all these photographic resolutions of your hair and fabric and your voice. But the important thing that they seem to be catching is the kind of micro expressions on your face, which they can then transmit, and then eye contact. And those three things of eye contact, micro expressions, your body movement, in other words, and your voice really are enough to convince you that you might look a little kind of odd, strange, vaporous, but you feel like you're really there. And that is going to be very, very powerful for both education, work, and entertainment.
You've written that virtual reality is creating the next evolution of the internet. But when I read stuff like that, I have to wait a second. What about some of the factors that could cause virtual reality to not be as big a deal as you think they would be? Where should we be a little careful about predicting what it's going to do?
Yeah, I was wrong. You know, as I said, I thought it was going to happen in 89. It didn't. And people thought, well, Google Glass, which was not too long ago, was going to revolutionize things. And Google Glass, there was a couple things that I think were part of its failure. One is it was recording outward. It was people really got freaked out by the fact that it was recording them in your glasses, people walking around recording. And secondly, it just kind of looked dorky.
The social part of that was interesting. I mean, Google Glass allowed you to get all this information and record things around you, but it was dorky and it was kind of socially unacceptable. Now, virtual reality, you put a headset on, talk about dorky.
Exactly. Right. So how many people are going to really be proud to put on their helmet while they're at work, and they won't be able to see their coworkers? But actually, in the HoloLens version, you can see your coworkers, which is the advantage. So I think that's one thing, is this dork factor, which has to be overcome by making the stuff even smaller, thinner, lighter. The second thing is there are a couple of technical hurdles that have to be overcome with the field of vision and the lighting. And thirdly, we want these things to be really, really light, and just the battery power necessary is working against that. So there may be a long time when we actually are carrying things in our pocket or whatever. So those are three of the things that I think are the immediate engineering hurdles that people have. The social hurdles of whether you're going to be comfortable, we kind of feel people are not only distracted but sometimes antisocial by looking down at their phones all the time, but we'll have this another version of putting on your glasses and now I'm not there, or you're not paying attention to me. I think there'll be a social etiquette moment, but here's why I'm kind of very optimistic about that we can learn. Remember when cell phones first came in, 15 years ago, before there were smartphones, and they were loud ringers always going off? People's cell phones were always being ringing, and they were yelling into their phones, and we thought, imagine if everybody had this, this will be intolerable. Well, what happened was we invented a technology called, the vibrator thing. And suddenly, you can go into a movie theater, and no cell phones are going off, and everybody's actually fairly obedient these days about turning off their cell phones and not looking at the screens. And so I'm hopeful that we can actually learn how to socialize these things, including how we would use VR.
Kevin Kelly, what will be the benchmarks that signal that widespread acceptance of VR and VR technology, that it's really here? We see a lot of money going into it. We see a lot of buzz about it, a lot being written about it. What's really going to signal that it's happened?
A couple of people have said one signal was, if can you buy it in Best Buy? That's one thing, and that's probably going to happen in a year. The other thing would be that if you couldn't get kids to give it up, which is already happening, I think the real thing would be like the second year after you've purchased the gear, are people still using it, a year later? And that's going to be the real test. I think because the Google Glass, or even sometimes a Fitbit, people wear it for a year and then they don't come back to it. So I think that second year after purchase would be a real tell that this is going to be sticky and persistent. And so I would say it's not this year because everybody's trying it out, but like what happens 18 months from now?
And what about the impact of virtual reality on incumbent technologies? They're rarely knocked out. We're still doing radio, all these many years after movies and television. But will it have an impact on some of the incumbent technologies like film, like television?
A lot of the people who make film and are in studios are rushing to try to make VR versions or VR experiments to try and stay ahead. I think there will be a move. Some of the things that film do will move, and not all the things. That's generally what happens. But I think I think it would be a couple more years before that narrative storytelling it moves to VR, because I think inherently VR has lots of much more freedom than the narrative story. I think where we're going to see the one question people ask is like, where will the time come for VR? What's it going to be taken from?
Because it's not like radio. You're not going to be that and while you're cooking.
Right, right. I think the time will also continue where the time is being stolen for a lot of other things. It's like from TV, from broadcast television. I think there's still time to be taken from there, grabbed from there. And I think another thing is, what are we going to do when the robots are driving our cars? And I think the answer is very clear. We're going to do VR.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because another chapter of your book, The Inevitable, about technologies shaping our future is called Cognifying. And in that, you write, it's hard to imagine that anything that will change everything as much as cheap, powerful, ubiquitous artificial intelligence. Let's step back for a moment. What is artificial intelligence? And maybe give us one example of its potential to change everything.
Yeah. Artificial intelligence is kind of a moving target, because whenever we accomplish whatever we think AI is, artificial intelligence, we redefine it and say, well, that wasn't it. It's something we haven't done yet. Like Siri is Siri or your Google now, is that AI? Well, it would have been 50 years ago, and now it's sort of like, no, that's just machine learning. That's just algorithms. But artificial smartness, artificial learning, artificial intelligence is being used right now in many fields, invisibly. We don't see them, but to people diagnosing x-rays better than doctors. They're used in the field of legal evidence where they can go through piles and piles of evidence better than a paralegal. When you fly a long distance on an airplane, the AI is flying at all but 7 minutes, which is what the human pilots fly. And, you know, things like in your brakes of your in a modern car are a little AI chip that brake better than you do. So those are kind of examples. And again, we don't think of them as AI because they're already here. But recently, of course, everybody's heard about the fact that AlphaGo from Google beat the world's Go master. That's an AI achievement. The next step actually is to get the AI to pass the physics AP exam, which is actually probably within just a couple of years. And maybe while you're at it, you can actually pass the law exam for that matter. These are just benchmarks to try and prove that this is useful. But it's being used, in the background in many, many ways. And I think we're going to first see it in the kind of way that Alexa and Amazon locally in Seattle is using it as a conversational assistant. I think this is where most people were going to feel this for the first time.
And Alexa is an appliance. You can talk to it and say, turn the lights on, turn on this radio. I want to hear some Rolling Stones.
I want to order something.
I would like the lights to go down. So it's kind of assisting you in that way. Take us 5 years down the road. We've talked about things that are here right now. Where do you see us in 5 years with artificial intelligence affecting our daily life?
Right. So let me say a couple things about artificial intelligence very briefly. One is that this AI, this artificial smartness, is not human-like. And that's part of its feature, part of its benefit, is that it is often much more narrow and its achievements, and it can do things that we can't do. The reason why we want it to drive our auto-driven cars is because it doesn't drive like us. It's not distracted. It's not thinking about whether it left the stove on. It's just going to drive. And so we're making many different types of thinking, many different types of AI, not just a single kind. And all these different kinds have different uses and will specialize in doing different things like, going marketing or this conversational bot. These will all be different kinds. And these different kinds of AI are going to become a commodity that we are delivered on the cloud much in the same way that we delivered artificial power, electricity, on the grid. And that you'll be able to actually today, right now Google's selling it, you can buy as much AI as you want to apply to whatever problem you have, just like you can buy as much artificial power as you want to electrify your thing. So the way I would say it is that everything that we've electrified on through a grid, we're now going to cognify through a grid, and it becomes a commodity. So that means in the same way that we had this huge industrial revolution where we took this artificial power so that you didn't have to make things with human muscle or animal muscle, you could use 250 horses to power your car down the road. Now we're going to have 250 minds in addition to the 250 horses to make the auto-driven car. We can take these artificial minds and apply it to everything that we already have automated. And so the formula that I like to suggest to people is the next 5 years is take something and make it smarter and cognify it. So here's an idea. Let's take taxis and we'll make them smarter. That's called Uber. That's the kind of thing that we're going to be doing.
Won't it's pitched as a convenience. It'll allow you to live your life more easily. But at the same time, the companies that control this technology are just a few oligarchy of companies. How do we know that this will not eventually turn into something more for their benefit than for our benefit?
Well, yes. Is Google more for Google's benefit than our benefit? We don't even know that question. Or Amazon, for that matter. We don't even know. I mean, the answer so far, because they are companies and they have to survive, is unless they can satisfy both of them, they're not going to last for very long. So I think that we are sharing benefits, but of course they're benefiting as well. The thing about these natural monopolies, whenever you have networks, you have network effects, which means that the natural monopolies tend to aggregate very big. So the biggest get bigger and bigger, and the bigger they get, the better they get, and the better they get, the bigger they get. Those are natural monopolies. And the thing about the natural monopolies is they swell up very fast, but they also collapse just as fast. So where is Microsoft as a monopoly? Everybody was worried about that 2 decades ago. They're not. They were displaced by Google. Everyone's worried about Google, but Google is at its peak right now. Before that was IBM. So these natural monopolies will happen. And it's likely that there will be an AI natural monopoly. It's unlikely to be Google or anything exists right now, although they are the big players. History of technology would suggest it's going to be a disruptive force from the outside. But they will also not last very long because somebody will invent an AI that's 10 times better, and everybody will immediately move over to that one.
But if you get the best AI, it's going to invent itself, will invent the next. Well, and it's owned by one company. There you go.
As a matter of fact, right now, Facebook is using its AI to develop better AI algorithms right now today.
Success in that, and who's going to catch up with Facebook?
Well, that's one way to do it, but it's not the only way, because they're using the same algorithm to improve the versions of it. But what if somebody in London or China comes up with a completely radical idea? So let me give you one example. The way that all the AIs work today is they work on huge data sets. That's why all the big AI players are Google and Amazon and Microsoft and Baidu, because they have the big data, because it takes millions of examples to train them. A little baby, a human baby, to learn the difference between a cat and dog doesn't take a million examples. It takes only 12. What if somebody outside of them learns how to figure out how to train the AI in a few data sets? They no longer need the big data. They can be a young startup and they can disrupt the whole place.
Artificial intelligence gets better because it learns from our intelligence.
Yes.
And it takes information from us. But we know that our intelligence is highly imperfect. There are many things in our thought patterns that are just wrong. We're not very good at estimating economic reality.
Or probabilities.
Or probabilities. Faced with facts which dispute core beliefs, we reject them, even if they're factual. So how do we know that AI isn't going to adopt some of our mental quirks at the same time as it's adopting to us?
It certainly, that is a possibility. But another possibility is it actually learns to think in some ways more logical than us. We also, it's possible for us to teach to be more ethical than us, because what all you said about our own intelligence is true about our ethics, which are very inconsistent, not very deep. Today, actually, there is AIs who are used in making mathematical proofs. And the curious thing about these very, very complicated mathematical proofs is that there is no human who understands them. We just have to accept that the AI was constructed in a way that their proof is proof. And even though you can look inside it and you just can't make any sense, the mathematicians can't make any sense of it. But he says, this AI says this is true. Do we want to believe it or not? And we're going to have more occasions like that where a decision of the AI was not going to be transparent to us.
There is artificial intelligence which just does things for us. Maybe it will be able to drive our cars for us. And then there's the notion of humans combining their brains with computers. And you note the chess player Garry Kasparov, who with a computer has become even a better chess player, able to beat computers sometimes. Some people see these as two very different approaches, one of which infantilizes us and the other of which makes us stronger and actually improves humans. Do you think there is that divide?
Generally, the answer to the path of technologies is usually all of the above. As you noted before, there's very few technologies that go away. Usually we have an additive process where we add another choice onto it. So there will be some AIs that will be sold or marketed or engineered to be just by themselves. But in fact, our own intelligences are really just a suite of multiple kinds of thinking, multiple instruments of cognition. So we have deductive reasoning, and we have recall, and we have spatial navigation, all these different kinds of intelligence. It's not a single vector. That's where we have kind of a rat, you know, a chimp, a dumb person, a smart person, a genius, like it's getting louder. No, that's a completely wrong vision of intelligence. What we have is more like a symphony of different notes and different cognitions. And some of those same instruments are used in animals, and they may actually have louder or superior instruments that we share, and some of them are much smaller. Well, we're going to engineer the artificial intelligence is to have extremely high fidelity in certain kinds of thinking and be low in others. And so this idea that we want to complement, in some senses, the different kinds of thinking to make a larger team effort in trying to solve a problem. There may be scientific problems that our own kind of human intelligence alone is insufficient to solve. We may need to invent other kinds of intelligences that we can work with and complement to actually solve the most difficult problems in the world.
As artificial intelligence becomes more and more ingrained, it relies on a network. It also relies on a power network. Our power went out here for a few hours overnight, not that long ago. Last year, it went out for a couple of days in our neighborhood. As we become more dependent on these things that rely on networks, could the downfall of the electric grid even temporarily prove to be catastrophic?
Catastrophic is a very strong word. It could certainly be a disaster, a natural disaster in a sense. If the internet went down in a very large area for more than 24 hours, yes, we would feel it. Everything would be impacted. It would be like having an earthquake or beyond. And so what we wanted to do is make sure that doesn't happen or it doesn't happen very often. And in a curious way, we can actually have AI helping us prevent that from happening by monitoring all the kinds of things that would bring it down. And I think that's actually what civilization is that we have multiple layers and layers and layers to try and make sure that this very complex system stays robust. The answer is not to simplify it. That doesn't work. The answer is to add other layers, which is how your body works. Your body has multiple ways to prevent you from dying.
How about jobs in the future where many things are able to be done by intelligent machines? In the past, we've always seen new jobs developing, but we're talking really about a large factor here of jobs going away. Journalist jobs. There are already AIs that will write short sports stories. Give them the stats and they'll write it up in perfectly good language. Short business stories can be written up by computers. Are we at a point where so many jobs are going away that people won't have productive work to do?
Yes. Most of the jobs that are going to AI and robots and will go to them in the future are tasks that we can define in terms of efficiency or productivity. In other words, it's something that there's a measurement and you're working towards it and you're trying to make it more efficient. And those are all the kinds of things that can go to AI and robots, including not just manual labor, but as you said, white-collar work, doing a mortgages, doing lawyerly evidence, X-ray examination, all these kinds of things which can be measured, are going to be automated. And that leaves humans to do the kinds of jobs which AI, for a long time, we're not going to be very good at, which is wasting time, which is basically things that are inefficient. Some of the best things we do are inefficient, like science. Science, by definition, you've got to make mistakes. You have to have failure. If you're never making any mistakes in doing science, you're not learning anything. So it is inherently inefficient. Innovation is inherently inefficient because you're going to try stuff that doesn't work. You're making prototypes. These are all wastes of time in a kind of a large sense, but they're absolutely necessary to explore. So any kind of exploration is inherently inefficient, not good for robots and AI. And that is also true for human experiences. Interpersonal relationships are terribly inefficient. Chit-chat, that's not accomplishing anything. And so all these kinds of things that the humans are really good at are things that machines are not very good at all. And these are also things that we're going to pay a lot of money for. These are the only kinds of things right now that are increasing in prices. Everything else that we can make in terms of productivity is on a long-term trend downward, except for these other things. And so, therefore, these are not just jobs that are cerebral or symbol processing. Sitting by someone on the bedside when they're sick is not something you need a PhD to do. You just need to be human to do that. And those are the things that we're actually paying a lot of money for.
Finally, Kevin Kelly, a few questions about you. I spoke to you back in 2010. And you've been writing about technology for years, and I thought it was wonderful you didn't have a cell phone, and you would not take a laptop with you when you were traveling. Is that still true?
No.
Now you have a cell phone and a laptop?
I have both. So just like the Amish. The Amish haven't rejected technology. They're just the last to get it, which is really true if you look at the Amish, how they're working. They're just a 50-year cycle behind the rest of us. The Amish, by the way, have adopted cell phones, so I feel okay, too.
That's great. Okay, that's all I got. Thank you very much.
Well, it was a real pleasure. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And the last chapter of the book is called the Triumph of Questions Over Answers, because in the world that we're headed to, if you want to answer, you ask a machine. If you want to question, you ask humans, because questions are far more valuable than answers, and you ask some great questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.